Hallo Eike, hörst du uns?
Wie ist das denn?
Sind alle Jungs schon?
Is it really that bad? It looks okay for me. Okay. So, okay, so it's this will be based on work. So some of this will be a little bit old, sort of a year old, and then I'll talk about some more recent stuff towards the end. And this will be work done in collaboration with Jerome Gauntlet, who people here probably know. He's been using it for a year. Dario Martelli is at IAS, and Yao probably needs no introduction. Okay. All right. So the basic setting for everything I'll say today is the ABS-CFT correspondence in a particular set. So we're always going to be in type 2B string theory on product space, ABS 5, five-dimensional anti-consistent space-time, with L. So L is going to be a compact 5-manifold. So this is a so-called Freund-Rubin background. And in particular, there's a 5-form of type 2B supergravity, and there's some number of units of flux that 5-form is background. And this L here is, I'll come to the definition in a moment, is a Sozaki-Einstein platform. So I'll come to what that means in a moment. And then the ABS-CFT correspondence says that for every one of these backgrounds on the left-hand side, there should be a dual superconformal field theory in four dimensions. So if you recall, this field theory is supposed to live on the conformal boundary of anti-consistent space-time, therefore lives in four dimensions, and it'll have minimal supersymmetry, superconformal symmetry, as well. So this is a pretty rich setup to think about. So what is all I have to explain now is what this geometry is. What is this Sozaki-Einstein manifold? In fact, the quickest definition is as follows. So L is a Riemannian manifold with metric G sub L. And then that's Sozakian definition, if and only if its cone is Kähler. So this is what you do. You take L, you take the product with the positive real line, and I'll call that x zero. And then you put this conical metric on it, but g is dr squared plus r squared times the metric on L. So that looks like a cone. And if that cone is Kähler, then the metric that you first thought of here is gl, it's here, this is accurate. So that's a slightly perverse definition, but it's the quickest one. And then this is Sozaki-Einstein, this manifold, if and only if this cone is also Ricci flat. Okay, so it's a pretty simple calculation to show that this cone metric is Ricci flat, if only if the metric G is a positive Einstein. It's very simple. Okay, so I'll explain a little bit more detail later about this geometry. What about some examples? Well, there are two. Well, the first example is known to everyone. So you take X, so it makes the subscript 0, it's gone away. So to get X 0 here, I just delete the origin of C3. And then that's r plus times x5. That was the last question. And then I take the flat metric on C3, so I get the nice round metric on S5. I put that here on the left-hand side, that's ABS5 plus S5, it's round metric. And that's dual to maximally supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory in four dimensions. So that's the ABS-CFT correspondence as originally stated. Okay, and that's, of course, very interesting. Many papers have been written on this in the last, eight years. Second interesting example is conifold. So, well, I've not really written what that is, but it's another one of these types of metrics. And this is dual instead to, rather than just an SUN gauge theory, n here is the number of units of flux. It's an SUN plus SUN theory that was studied by Levinoff and Whitman in some detail. So it's then quite a remarkable fact that until just a couple of years ago, these were essentially the only two examples where both sides of that correspondence were known explicitly. So there are some caveats here. There are some implicitly known metrics from existence arguments, but they weren't known explicitly, so you can't do some of the detailed calculations that people have now done. Those are the only two examples where you have an explicit metric and also a field theory where you can do calculations, which is kind of remarkable. But that changed 2 years ago, so this is where my work came in, with a paper with Jerome Gauntlett, Dario Martelli, myself, and Dan Waldron. So we constructed an infinite number of these ABS backgrounds, so an infinite number of these Sasaki-Amstam metrics, and they all live on the same manifold, so they all live on S2 plus S3. They're labeled by two positive integers, p and q, with highest common factor 1, and q less than p. So for every such p and q, we've got one of these Einstein metrics, or supersymmetric Einstein metrics, on S2 plus S3. They're completely explicit. I've not written them down, but I could do. It doesn't really help very much. Completely explicit, and they're cohomogeneity 1, which means you have an isometric group action by a group with this Lie algebra, such that the generic orbit is cohomogeneity 1. That's basically why you can write it down explicitly. The other important thing you need to know is there's the volume. So this would be one of the main points of my talk. So if you look at the volume of these Einstein manifolds relative to pi cubed, just gets rid of pi's, then you get this rather unlikely looking expression here, and notice the square roots in terms of 4p squared minus 3q squared. Okay, and then the it wasn't too long before the field theories were constructed back with Ami, so there, and these other people. It turns out that they are all quiver gauge theories, or also called loose theories. So P here in the PQ, P determines the number of SUN factors in the gauge group, or if you know what a quiver is, it's the number of nodes in the quiver. And the Q parameter determines exactly what that quiver is, or the matter content, and also determines the superpotential, which determines interactions. So, I mean, this would be a different talk to explain those details, but they all worked out a couple of years ago. So, an important check on this duality is, well, got two sides, you say they're dual to each other, what do you, how do you know that that's true? So, well, the most impressive check is A maximization. So this is also pretty recent, it's just a couple of years old. And so this works as follows. So we're now on the field theory side, we've got N equals 1 superconformal field theory in 4 dimensions. So you have a conformal algebra, let's say 4.2 in 4 dimensions, and then there's also importantly, this U1 R symmetry. So you have a global U1 R symmetry, and that plays an important role in the story. So this R symmetry satisfies two properties. Firstly, it's conserved in a quantum sense. And secondly, this is almost by definition, the superpotential has R charge 2. These two people here, Ken Chirgetti and Ryan Wecht, showed that the exact R symmetry of field theory is actually determined by a very simple optimization problem. So suppose you have some UV field theory, and you have a candidate R symmetry, UV, which is conserved, and superpotential has R charge 2, and then you can determine the exact R symmetry thing in infrared theory by locally maximizing this function. So if you take the space of all symmetries which satisfy these two constraints, and then you just locally maximize this cubic function of R. So the trace here is a sum over Fermi force, in theory. So I'm not going into any details here, just not to give you a flavor of what the logic is. So you locally maximize this function, and at the critical point, function is precisely the acentral charge of the field theory. So formal field theories have central charges. In four dimensions, there are two of them. So you take the trace of the stress energy tensor, the expectation value in the background where you couple to Excel metric, four-dimensional metric, and that one-point function takes this rather general form of the Weyl curvature squared, it's a trace free part of the Riemann tensor, and then there's this Euler density, which is another expression in terms of the Riemann tensor, and the coefficients are called CNA in this general expression, and the important one is A. So in particular, Cardy conjectured in the late 80s that this A central charge should count massless degrees of freedom in the theory. And it then sort of kind of follows from that you have this A conjecture that for any RG flow, that A in infrared will always be less than A in UV. So this is just one's intuition about RG flow. Coarse grading, you should lose degrees of freedom as you go to the infrared. Okay, good. So here comes the ADS-CFT correspondence, and this tells you that this A central charge in the field theory, relative to the one of N equals 4 Young Mills, is volume of S5 divided by the volume of this Einstein. So this is where the ADS-CFT relation comes in, and that's where this volume comes in. So this was the first very impressive check of this duality. This whole infinite set of theories, you can actually, because we knew these quivers, you can compute this so-called trial A function, and here it is, in terms of P and Q, and two variables R1 and R2, maximize that, and you get precisely the volume you get by solving the Einstein equations. So it's pretty amazing agreement. Okay, so someone who's geometrically inclined, my immediate question is, okay, I've done this funny field theory calculation, it gave me a volume, a rather unlikely expression, how on earth can I explain that geometrically? So that's my first question. And moreover, this A maximization implies these volumes are always algebraic numbers, so they solve polynomial equations with coefficients which are integers. And the question is geometrically why? How does that come about? What are those integers? So these were the two questions that I was interested in. So in the rest of the talk, I'll roughly explain to you the answers to those questions. And then, in a kind of related, but on a slightly different track, I'll explain to you some obstructions that obstruct the existence of these metrics. So they are quote-unquote collabials that don't actually have Ricci flat Kalman metrics. And these correspond to supersymmetric quantum field theories that don't flow to dual IR fixings. So there are some, there are these two papers here for which the second point is relevant. Actually, the second one is more relevant. So, well, I'll explain this later. So there are quote-unquote collabials that don't actually have Ricci flat Kalman metrics, which occurs. I'll get to that later. Okay. So I need to tell you a little bit more about geometry. So there'll be a couple of slightly painful transparencies. Okay, so it's exactly in geometry. So I've already told you that if you take something like a manifold, L with metric GL, that Suzaki if and only if its cone is Kappa. So what does that mean? Well, first of all, this x0 needs to be a complex, so you can introduce some local complex coordinates zi, complex conjugate z bar I. And the fact that this is a Kähler cone means that you can write the metric in this form. So if you're familiar with Kähler geometry, r squared, which is this radial direction on the cone, is actually the Kähler potential. So the metric takes this simple Hessian form. Well, this is just by definition. So because we have a complex manifold, there's a complex structure tensor, J, so this is a tensor with one index up and one index down, squares to minus one, and these holomorphic and anti-holomorphic coordinates, the plus or minus I index tensor. And this is just due to all complex manifolds, of course. So then a very simple calculation tells you that if you take RdBr, which is a vector field that generates this conical symmetry, and you act on it with a complex structure tensor, you get this vector that I call psi, and remarkably, it's always a killing vector field. And it's also holomorphic. And it has a name, it's called Reed vector field. So, not surprisingly, this is due to the R symmetry in the superconformal field. So R symmetries always have this global U1 symmetry, and correspondingly in the geometry side, we always have this Killing vector field, which is naturally defined.
Why is it holomorphic? Any simple way to see it?
Sorry?
Why is it holomorphic?
Well, it kind of follows from the definitions. I mean, RdBr is also holomorphic.
Can you see just by plotting J, please?
It's not incredibly quick, no. I mean, it's in the appendix of one of my papers, if you want to look at it. But it's a one-page calculation, so I won't do it. It's not difficult, but you have to compute. Okay. Okay, so in the superconformal field theory, what did we do? So I want to understand this A maximization. I want to understand what on earth I was doing geometrically to get this volume coming out. So we had an optimization problem, this A maximization, for the R symmetry, which determines the central charge at the critical point of the exact central charge. So the obvious thing to do in the geometry is just to replace this by geometrical things. So instead of an optimization problem for the R symmetry, I'll replace this by this vector field, psi, which I just introduced. And moreover, this optimization problem should determine then the volume of the Einstein manifold at the critical point. So that was the thinking. So, and then I'll explain how this works for the particular case of the toric geometry. So I don't know how familiar people are with that, but the reason I'm focusing on this is just it's easier, I can draw pictures. So hopefully the geometry will be a bit more intuitive. So I just explained to you that we always have at least one holomorphic and actually killing direction. So you always have at least a U1 isometry. And if I'm going to look for an optimization problem for this thing, I need at least a T2, because I want to move this vector field. So I'm going to go one step further and assume that I actually have an n-dimensional torus symmetry. And throughout this talk, you can just put little n equals to 3 all the way through for Calabi-Yau 3-4. I just put n to make it a little bit more general. Okay. So I have an n-dimensional torus, and I'll introduce some coordinates phi I, which are just the periodic coordinates on that torus. I goes from 1 up to n. So these are just the angular coordinates on that torus.
Jim?
Yeah.
Can you have an example which is just U1 single?
Yeah, sure.
And the collection of polyomic charges, you still have the minimization problem?
Not in the geometry, no. In that case, there would be no optimization problem to do. Yeah.
So you must have at least a T2.
You must have at least a T2 for this to be interesting, what I'm going to say. Yeah. But you won't get all of these nice algebraic numbers and things like that, which is what I wanted to understand. So, I mean, if you don't have a T2, then you don't have any of this anything. So, and there's no, then there's nothing to understand.
All the YPQs, this use this commission is satisfied.
Absolutely, yeah. The YPQs all look like what I'm explaining now. As do many others. They're talking here. Yeah. It just means you have as much isometry, torus isometry, TN as you do end to end is the dimension of complex dimension. So the biggest torus symmetry you can have. Okay, then, so using the metric, Xi is this mean vector field, remember, that's the R symmetry direction. And then I can take these torus generators, and I just take the inner product of these two, that gives me some function, that gives me N. There's a yi. So we've now got n coordinates on the torus, we've got n coordinates yi, that's 2n real coordinates on a 2n dimensional manifold, just enough to count the manifold. Okay, so in fact these coordinates are quite nice, and it turns out that these geometries always look like a torus vibration over polyhedral cones sitting inside Rn. So here I've drawn a picture. So you should think of these yi coordinates as just standard coordinates on Rn. Okay, so in this picture, the yi runs from 1 to 3, it's going to be x3, and they're just the standard coordinates on Rn, on R3. So I'll explain this a little bit more in the next transparency. What is this convex polyhedral cone thing? You take some number of hyperplanes. You intersect them all through the origin, and that defines some nice convex cone, which looks like this. And explicitly, there will be some number of vectors, VA, with integer coefficients. There's another variable, D. So D is the number of hyperplanes. So in this picture, D is 4. So you should be able to see 4 hyperplanes in that picture. And the cone is just defined by these inequalities. Y dot dA is given 0. And that defines the interior of this cone. So in a bit more detail, so I've got this cone above in R3, or Rn. Above every point in the interior, I have a copy of this torus. Okay? So above in the interior of the cone, I just have a product of the interior times this torus, and that's what this these spaces look like. But then at the boundary, the bounding faces of the cone, one of the circles in this torus collapses, pinches off. And then it leaves an n-1 dimensional torus by the face, that bounding face of the cone. But now the circle subgroups inside a torus are specified by some charge vector, B, and the normal vector to the to the plane, precisely specified to which circle collapses. Okay. It's probably a lot of information to take in if you've not seen it before. So let me just give a couple of very easy examples.
Do you have as many hyperplanes as you want?
Yes,
in principle.
Absolutely.
Okay. And each one, on each hyperplane, you'll always have this kind of construction.
Yes, that's right. So yeah, in the interior of the cone, it's rather trivial, just put the torus trivially fine at every point. Then as you go to the boundaries, some of the circles pinch off. And which circle pinches off is determined by the normal vectors of that face. So if you know about moment maps and things, it's probably familiar in that language. If you don't, you can understand it in the way I've just described. So here's some very simple examples. So just think of a complex plane, or R2, and in polar coordinates. So if this is a circle which is fibered over the positive real line, and the circle just collapses at the origin. That's an incredibly trivial example. So that's something just one dimensional. But you can actually then just take n copies of this. So Cn is Tn, fibered over is positive orthant. And I can actually put a nice, I put the flat metric on Cn, looks like that. So the rho I is a finite polar coordinates on each complex plane. And then these coordinates yi are just half rho I squared.
What's the origin of this name?
What name?
Orphaned.
Yeah, it's just, you know what I mean, it's a corner of the room. Where does it come?
I don't know.
I don't know. I've got the right word. Okay, good. So we're nearly. Okay, one more. That's slightly painful. Okay, so now, so the important vector field, there's an important vector field in this game, and I wanted to find an extremal problem for this vector. That was my motivation. So I can write this R symmetry and this V vector field as a linear combination of tallest dimensions in the following way. So Bi is vector B that determines this vector field. And it turns out that this vector B always lives in the dual cone to the one that you start with. So the dual cone, if you're given some cone C star, then the dual cone is just a set of points in Rn which have positive products with all the points in the cone that you start with. Okay. So the space of vector fields also lives in the cone. If you remember from the definition of these coordinates yi, they're defined this way. So if you just plug this into here, and contract the I indices, you get that b dot y is just r squared. R squared, remember, is the cone direction. So this is what the geometry looks like. Remember that the Sasaki manifold lives at r equals 1 in this cone. The cone, Sasaki manifold lives at r equals 1 there. And then I have the following geometric picture. So the cone looks like a torus Tn, fibered over this polyhedral cone, but then the Sasaki manifold is just this hypersurface where b dot y equals 1/2. So what this vector field does is it determines precisely the normal vector to this hyperplane. So as you vary this R symmetry around, right, all you're doing is you just tilt this hyperplane. So that's going to be the optimization problem. It will be tilting this hyperplane inside this cone. There's then just one technical condition. So I also need that this space is Calabi-Yau in some sense. And that just means that these normal vectors can be put in the form of having a one first. A one in the first entry. So that means, in fact, there's a holomorphic body. So I won't bother you with that technical question. Okay, so now I've set up all the geometry, I can explain what this extremal problem is. It's very simple. So I'm looking for Einstein metrics. Einstein metrics are critical points of the Einstein-Hilbert action. So here is the Einstein-Hilbert action. L is my Sasaki manifold, which is the link at r equals 1 in this cone. And S of g is the Ricci scalar of g, so here's the Ricci scalar. And this cosmological constant just ensures that I get the right curvature, right cosmological constant. Okay, so the Einstein metrics are critical points of this function. So what's amazing now is that if I take this functional and I restrict it to a space of Sasaki metrics, the functional only depends on this vector field. So this is the most crucial point of what I'm saying so far, otherwise this wouldn't work. So the space of Sasaki metrics is infinite dimension. Okay, but as soon as I restrict this functional to that space of metrics, it only depends on this vector field, so it becomes finite dimension. So this is actually a function. The Einstein-Hilbert action is actually a function of the space of Sasaki metrics. Well, I kind of tried to explain roughly how that works here, but I'm not sure it's very helpful. So one has to do a calculation to check this is true, but that's the most important.
Is it clear why it does not depend on the limits of nodes? Is that just constants?
Sorry, say again.
So it's a rational function.
Well, it will be a rational function. We don't know that yet. All we know is it's just a function.
Okay.
It will be a rational function. I've not got that. Not got that yet.
Is it clear why?
Well, there are various ways of thinking about it, but I'm not sure if they would be helpful someone who's not thought about the geometry very carefully. So you just compute, right? So you can just compute that it only depends on this vector field. So any other metric which has the same vector field has the same value in this fraction. You just compute that.
So what determines that n minus 1, 3, 2 minus 1?
Oh, yes, yeah, so that just gives you the, this is just a normalization for the Ricci tensor.
So it's just a constant.
It's just a constant, yeah. And this just ensures that the Ricci tensor, when I do the Euler-Lagrange equation,
it's just the lambda
term. It's 2n minus 1.
Okay.
I mean, it's not important. It's just a normalization. It's just a cosmological constant. It gives you that number.
So if you thought about this functional as a functional on the whole space of Einstein matrix, how would you impose a constraint that lands you on the space of Sasakian matrix? I mean, somehow it would be nicer to have to start with a functional and then imposing a constraint kind of on the branch multipliers.
Yeah, I've not thought about that. I mean, it's not something that, because people do this type of thing in Taylor geometry as well, where you consider some functional, and you just consider a function on the space of Taylor metrics. I'm just doing the same thing as Sasakian metrics.
Yes.
Then you're asking, is there some Lagrange multiplier way of thinking about that?
I mean, for me, it would be more satisfying to start with something, and then
you
impose the restriction on the Lagrange,
yeah,
or on the action.
Yeah, I agree. That sounds more natural.
You want a Sasaki metric to come out as the answer.
Yeah.
But here you're just saying if you plug in a Sasaki sets,
right,
then you're going to get it depending only on the mean
vector. It's depending on a function of the space of Sasaki metrics.
Yeah, that's right.
Which is,
because there are lots of metrics that satisfy that.
Right, so it's a...
Right, so, yeah. And well, it's important also that this is it's an infinite dimensional function space still, but it just happens to... All of those infinite dimensional functional degrees of freedom just drop out when you put this function.
Just to understand, is a functional that you're considering multiple of a moment?
Excellent question. I mean, yes. So I shall get to that. Yes, that's on the next transparency. Okay, good. So obviously I can't explain to you all of the calculations, but I just want to keep it. So now, More calculation. So this depends only on this vector field. Remember, I characterized this vector field in terms of B. So remember, I wrote. Just picking some bases. So B is everything just depends on B. An n dimensional vector B. And here is the Einstein-Hilbert action. So you're absolutely right, some volume comes in. So and here it is. In fact, it's probably helpful if I draw another picture. I should probably have drawn more pictures, but I'm not very good at it. Okay, so you have this cone. So this is what you get by forgetting the torus directions on these spaces. And there's some hyperplane that sits here, and roughly speaking, its normal vector is B. That's my variational problem. I'm just tilting around this hyperplane, and that bounds this nice finite polytope, which I'm calling P of B. So this thing here is P of B, obviously it depends on B, and the Euclidean volume of this polytope is essentially the Einstein-Hilbert action, which is actually then the same as the volume of the Sasaki. But there's another factor. So there are some factors of n and 2 pi in this here, which don't matter. But also B1, the first coefficient of B, also matters. So I think I've said that. Volume is just the Euclidean volume. So this first component here, this B1, is singled out by the Calabi-Yau coefficient. That's what that comes from. If you take the derivative of this Einstein-Hilbert action, so the function, if you take the derivative in this sort of Euler direction, bi, so this Einstein summation, then if you do this on here, you get that b1 is equal to n. So the first component of this vector is n. And this is the same as saying that this holomorphic volume form has charge n, Or, more really, it's kind of saying that the superpotential has R charge too. So, okay, in field theory, this is basically that constraint. It's essentially a normalization. So this fixes the normalization of roughly where this plane sits. So you see, once you've done this extremization, you put V1 equals N in here, I just get the volume. So I now just have to extremize the volume in this property. Okay, that's a very cute problem, and it's easy to show that there's always exactly one critical point for that problem.
So this statement from the gauge theory means that our charge is equal to 2, and that it is a conserved current. Can you also go further and argue that this is a condition for conformal invariance? So that means that not just that superpotential has R charge 2, but rather it has the size dimension of 3.
Not very directly. I mean, well, one can say some of these things in a sort of moral sense. Roughly conformal invariance is related to the conical symmetry of the cone. And supersymmetry is roughly the complex structure tensor. And then supersymmetry relates the conical symmetry to the R symmetry, which is much the same as in field theory as saying that superconformal symmetry relates the dilatation operator to the R charge.
Doesn't that immediately tell you what the correct R charge should be? Because once you have a conical structure, you always know the RD over DR constant dilatation invariance.
Right.
That would automatically pick it up as a correct R charge.
No, this is what I'm saying. That at least in the setup that I'm telling you about, it can move. So the vector RD over DR is not fixed, it can move around. As long as you have a torus symmetry, it can move. So, and then in the field theory side, this is the same as this A maximization problem, but in the UV, you don't know which is necessarily the correct R symmetry, unless there happens to be a unique U1.
But then I'm asking that at the end of the day, will the answer be RDR is the right killing vector corresponding to the true R symmetry?
Yeah, exactly.
But what I'm pointing out is that sort of an expected answer, because you know if you have a superconformal algebra, the dual.
Oh, I see.
So, absolutely.
They're just dual to each other. Yeah,
right. So you just put this extra framework of minimization in the geometry.
Right.
At the end of the day, you get what you would expect naively once you show that the R direction is a holographic direction.
Yes, absolutely, but. Yeah, but I'm still doing something non-trivial in this problem. In that, well, as you get these non-trivial numbers coming out, algebraic numbers and so on. Only at the critical point is there then an ADS.
Yeah, it's only at the critical point, right?
So we're off shell. All of this is kind of off shell. Okay, but then I'm looking at critical points, which means I'm on shell. So I guess this is a bit more mathematical, I guess. Okay, so B1 equals N actually also defines a holotope in the dual cone, which I think N. So this cone is the space of these vector fields. B to be the volume of this holotope. And it's quite easy to compute its first and second derivatives. So we want to set the first derivative to zero. The second derivative shows you that this volume is a nice convex function. Of course, it's bounded below by zero, its volume. You can also show that it diverges to plus infinity at the boundary here. So you've got a nice convex function of convex space. It's bounded below, diverges to infinity at the boundary, so it has a unique orbit. This is intuitively obvious, so it's very easy to prove rigorously. Moreover, so I've not done the whole story. All I've done is determine this critical vector field. I've still not solved the full Einstein equation. But some people who are much better at analysis than me have shown there always exists a solution. So for all of these toric Calabi-Yau cones, which is what I've been discussing, they all have a unique psi Einstein measure. This is now proved by these people who are backing it very well. So in fact, the methods to prove this were already around from Kähler geometry. They just needed slight adapting. But obviously, I'll go into those details.
So they proved that there is a unique solution. That's the
So uniqueness of the vector field follows from what I've said. And then the difficult bit is existence of the solution. And that's what they proved.
For toric?
The toric. Yeah. So for example, DP2, we didn't know the metric, but they proved that it exists. So that's all fine. So at the end of my talk, we'll get on to examples that don't exist. So I should probably speed up a little bit. Okay, so I just wanted to go through an example, since this is perhaps a bit abstract. So I put n equals 3, that's the complex dimension number. And I've got a polyhedral cone, so in three dimensions, so I can obviously order the faces of the cone in cyclic order. So I've done that there. And then, using sort of high school maths, you can just, you just have to compute the volume of the polyhedron. So, not surprisingly, it's written in terms of 3x3 determinants. So that it's a 3x3 determinant in the product of two 3x3 determinants. So the b's here, remember, describe the cone. They have integer, they're integer vectors, and the b is the vector field of the variable. So you can put in the data for these YPQ things, in terms of p and q. It's a simple set of four vectors. And you just plug it in, and you get some horrible function of p and q. So, I mean, this should be reminding you of the A maximization you did earlier. It's a horrible function, you extremize it, and you get precisely the right volumes. So, at least for these YPQ things, and also for some generalizations, which I worked out actually using the PAMI, there are now three different ways of getting these formulas. You solve the Einstein equations explicitly, and there's some subtle global analysis that goes into that. There's this geometric optimization problem, and there's also A maximization, and they all give the same ones.
Okay, good.
So, well, I should probably skip the next part. So this is for toric. I wanted to explain a little bit about how this generalizes when you don't have quite so much symmetry. In fact, you can't do what I just did. So it's actually a more difficult problem. You can't solve it in the way that I just solved. So I wanted to give you some idea of what you do. But I won't go into any details. Okay, so in general, you're still going to have some torus symmetry, which is going to be maximal dimension. And the way that you then get to this volume formula and show that it's related to algebraic numbers and so on, when you extremize it, is via localization. So let me describe roughly how that goes. So the first thing you do is this trick. So you can write the volume of this Suzuki manifold as an integral over the whole cone of e to the minus r squared times omega is just the k form of this curve. So it's a trick. So if you do the r integral, it cancels this funny factor here. And you just get left with the r with what's left at r equals 1. So you then square root this, and you see that this r squared over 2 is a Hamiltonian function for the spectrum. So what that means is that d of h is minus the vector field contracted into k. That's by definition what a Hamiltonian function means. This is maybe familiar from just classical mechanics, and symplectic geometry. So this volume now looks like e to the minus h, and then some integral. So it looks like a classical partition function, where the cone and omega are in the phase space. So in fact, it is a phase space in a physical sense. So this is the last paper I wrote in the summer. It's actually a phase space, a classical partition function for a BPS three plane. But I won't explain. Anyway, so then there's a localization formula that you can apply. So you've noticed this, called the Deussmann-Heckmann formula. And it says that the integral localizes, so it means you can compute it precisely where this vector field vanishes. But see, then we immediately hit a problem, because the norm squared of this vector field is r squared. So we're supposed to evaluate this integral at a singular point, at the tip of this cone, which is singular. So there's no way we're going to get any sensible expression because it's singular. So what you do is you therefore have to resolve the singularity. So in order to get a sensible answer from this, you actually have to resolve the singularity, which is quite interesting, because the gauge theory is a kind of resolution of singularity. So and then the upshot is that you always get a rational function of this vector field, which means by which I mean polynomial over polynomial, with rational coefficients. So I mean, Hanley alluded to that earlier. And then, therefore, when you take the extremal problem, this is where the algebraic numbers come from. So what are these rational coefficients? Not surprisingly, they're topological invariants. And, well, there's no way I'm going to explain this slide. But here's the answer. I just want to flash it. So the vector field is, here's the volume. The vector field enters here, and here. You didn't need to worry about this first term here. But the important parts are these UMs, which are some weights, in particular they're integer or rational, and also Chern classes. That's where these rational numbers come in. That's what I want to say, by the way. So in terms of these toric pictures, we're doing something quite different. What we're doing is we're chopping off the tip of the cone. So here's what you do. You take your polyhedral cone that you started with, so we sort of went out like this. The tip of the cone is singular, corresponds to singular points. So what you do is you chop it with some number of rational hyperplanes. So rational just means that the normal vector has integer entries. That's what rational always means here. Such that the cone satisfies the following thing. So at each vertex, so here are four vertices in this picture, you have precisely n edges meeting at that vertex. So you can see here that there are three here, three here. But the original cone had four meeting. So that's why it's singular, in fact. And moreover, if you then look at these vectors, they should span z, n, and z. So it's some spanning condition for these edge vectors in each vertex. And this can always be done. It's not always, but you can always do that. And then here's a nice formula, and it's kind of analogous to what happens in the topological string. The volume is given by this very simple sum over vertices of this polytope, and then times just b dot 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 u. So we just take the Euclidean product of b with the edge vectors of the vertex. And these are exactly the same vertices that appear in topological string or toric things. So this is much simpler.
So how do you argue that the formula does not depend on the formalization?
Right. So, in this case, by construction, I mean the left-hand side does not depend on the resolution you've taken. Now, in three dimensions, you can actually prove it explicitly. Basically, because all resolutions are related by chromophore transitions, and it's a local formula. So if you can show invariance for the conifold transition, you're done. And then you can just do that explicitly. But then in higher dimensions, that's not true. Not all resolutions can be related by simple. I don't mean conifold transitions. I mean flop. So in higher dimensions, that's not true. So that kind of proof doesn't work. But it's by construction. I mean, the left-hand side doesn't depend. So the right-hand side can. Right. But it's not immediately obvious. That's a good question. Okay, so let me move on to my second topic, which is kind of completely different. So this is with Jerome, who's also involved in this projects. Okay, so let me remind you that, so you take a compact Calabi-Yau manifold, so X now is going to be compact, omega is a holomorphic volume form, so explicitly X is some complex manifold, it emits a Kähler metric, and it has first term class theory, that's what you mean by Calabi-Yau manifold. And then Yau's very impressive theorem in the late 70s says that X always emits a unique Ricci flat Kähler metric in any given Kähler class. So the Kähler class defines some cohomology class on X, and there's always a unique metric. And this is very, very, very difficult to prove this horrible nonlinear analysis. And my main point here is that for non-compact manifolds, in particular the cones I've been talking about, this can go wrong in an interesting way. And then this is related to the infrared behavior of the gauge theories that maybe Ami has even been talking about, if you could talk here. So let me explain. And it's incredibly simple, but perhaps not immediately obvious. Okay, so let's suppose we have an Einstein manifold, L, with its Ricci tensor normalized, as I said up here. So it's positive curvature. So then there are two classical facts that you can look up in any textbook, and they're quite easy to prove. The first is Bishop's theorem, and that tells you that the volume, this Einstein manifold, is always bounded from above by the volume of the sphere. And in fact, I think it's equality even only if it's the sphere. That's called Bishop's theorem. And then there's also something called Lichnerowitz's theorem, which involves eigenvalues of the Laplacian. So delta L will be the scalar Laplacian. And this Lichnerowitz's theorem tells us that the smallest positive eigenvalue, E1, that scalar Laplacian, is bounded from below by the dimension of the manifold, which is 2n minus 1 here. And moreover, you get equality if it only fits the round sphere. So the Laplacian is that. Sign convention. It's positive. Okay, so.
So the second bound.
Yes.
Does this imply that the R charges must be greater than 1?
Right, I'll get to it. I'm about to explain. Okay, so let me. So the first one I've kind of explained already. I've been talking about volumes. In particular, I've explained their topological variance, or at least their holomorphic variance. And this is always true. The volume of these Slovakian things can always be computed using basically algebraic geometry methods, but maybe with some optimization thrown in. So you can compute the volume without knowing the metric explicitly at this point. But what about this Lichnerowitz thing? It's not so obvious for the Laplacian that you generally to compute the spectrum of the Laplacian to know the metric. In fact, it should be inverse. If you know the spectrum, you should know the metric. So how does this work? Okay, so let's go back to the cone. So x0, remember, is this complex manifold r plus times l. So that's our Calabi-Yau cone. And let's suppose that we have a holomorphic function on that cone, which is an eigenfunction of the Lie derivative under this Reed vector field. So what does all that mean? Well, first, this one just says that f is holomorphic, of course, because it depends on the z bars. And I also want f to be an eigenfunction under this Lie derivative. So psi is some Reed vector field, or possible R symmetry, and lambda will be some positive. So from these first two conditions, it follows that this f function is r to the lambda, r remember is the radial direction, times some f tilde, where f tilde is a function on L, the space that we're interested in. And moreover, a quick calculation shows you that this f tilde is actually an eigenfunction of the scalar Laplacian, with eigenfunction e, which is this quadratic expression in lambda, lambda's the charge. So I've managed to get an eigenfunction, an eigenvalue of the Laplacian without knowing anything about the metric. It's just holomorphic. All that goes in here is the holomorphic structure and this choice of vector field psi. That's all that goes in. And then this Lichnera expound just tells you that lambda is bigger than or equal to 1. That's what it says.
So this is a quadratic equation. What is the second condition?
Isn't one. Lambda is positive. Yeah, the other branch doesn't arise. So it only gives you lambda. So the idea here is that both the volume, as I've said, and this holomorphic spectrum are actually just holomorphic invariants. It's the same for fixed depth of field. So once I fix this this x0, which I could say be an algebraic variety or something, and I fix a choice of vector field psi, then I can compute the volume and I can compute the holomorphic spectrum. I don't need to know anything else. So this is how you get you can get contradictions. If you compute the volume and it's bigger than the volume of the sphere, then there can't exist an Einstein metric. Or if I can find a holomorphic function where this eigenvalue is less than 1, then I similarly get a contradiction. There can't be any Einstein metric. And in fact, most examples that you might want to write down don't sound viable in these properties. I'll get to that in a minute. Okay. But let me explain the physics of what I just said. So I just explained the geometry. The physics is just as easy. So here's what's going on with the Lichnera distribution. So if f is an eigenfunction of the scalar Laplacian on L with eigenvalue e, this quadratic expression, then that gives rise to some massive Kluze-Klein state in Aeneas 5. So I just do a Kluze-Klein reduction. It gives me some massive state where the mass is basically this e. By Aeneas CFT, that state in AES should be dual to some scalar chiral primary, O, in dual superconformal field theory. And then if you just trace through carefully the AES CFT with the KK reduction, the AES CFT map, you find that the conformal version of that operator is lambda, not surprising. And there's then, in any conformal field theory, there's a unitarity bound for the conformal dimensions of operators. In particular, for scalar operators in four dimensions, the conformal dimension must be bigger than or equal to 1. That is the Lichnera expound. Whether it was lambda bigger than or equal to 1. So that's incredibly simple. This Lichnera expound is the unitarity.
Is there a simple physical, appropriate physical thing for the inequality on volumes?
So the Bishop bound.
Before we get there, somehow in the geometry you seem to get already the super something which is equivalent to the superconformal algebra. Right, because this bound counts in the gauge theory by assuming superconformal algebra. And so when I asked you the previous question, somehow there was only restriction on R charge. It was a step to go to dimensions, but now somehow you do have it.
That's right. But I had to go through, KK reduction, the ADS CFT map, and so on. That's how I got from this lambda, which is the charge in this conical direction, to the field theory. So, there's some non-trivial steps people have worked out. KK reduction and then the ADS CFT map, and you can see there are details going there. It's not difficult, but that fills in some of the steps that you're going to use. Okay, good. So, and then the volume, which is what you just asked. So, here's the Bishop bound. Here's an intuitive explanation for it. It's not as vigorous as the one in the previous transparency, but it's probably morally correct. So, okay, here we go. So, suppose we have some superconformal field theory, which comes from some D3 brains at some singularity, which is what we've been dealing with before. So one expects that by giving devs to some of the fields in that theory, and then integrating out any mass fields, that you should be able to get to n equals 4 super young limits. So geometrically, giving these devs should correspond to moving the brains out to a smooth point of the geometry, moving the brains away from the scene. That's giving the devs, and then one integrates out mass fields that goes to the infrared. From the remarks earlier about this asexual charge, you expect it to be decreased under this process. Because I'm integrating things out after flowing to the infrared, the central charge should decrease under such a process. That's what one expects. And that then means that the A of n equals 4 super young Mills should be less than the A that you started with. But then if you use the ADS-CFT relation, this A, the A is just inversely proportional to the volumes, and then that's the Bishop count. So it's the volume of S5 is bigger than or equal to the volume of the Einstein apple. So that's probably morally the explanation. Okay, so in my last two transparencies, I'll give some examples. So there are examples that have appeared in a number of places in the physics question. So, I guess the main point here is that they don't admit these reached fact metrics because it's hard. So, almost the simplest Galabi-Yau singularities you can write down are the ones that you can write down. So, perhaps people are familiar with the ADE singularities in two dimensions. They're given by the zero sets of these polynomials, so z1, z2, z3 are three complex variables. If you take the zero set at h, you get some ADE singularity of two dimensions. But it's very simple to make those higher dimensional by just adding some more quadratic terms to the polynomial. So I can add as many quadratic terms as I like. And then I just take the zero set of this f. So f is just one of these ADE things plus some quadratic terms. I take a zero set of that, sits inside Cn plus 1, which is a very simple hypersonic singularity. In fact, these singularities are very well studied in math literature. People have computed all of the homology groups, including the torsion and everything. So they're very well studied. They're Calabi-Yau singularities, which means they have a holomorphic volume form. And there's an isolated singularity. In fact, then they look like codes. So these are exactly the things that I've been talking about, these text spaces. Okay. Good. So, the bottom line of what I said before is that once you go higher than the ADE singularities in two dimensions, once you go to three dimensions, essentially none of these exist. None of these have these Ricci flat K coefficients. That means none of them. So, they're the simplest things you can even write down. So, and then people have looked at this before. There's this paper. In fact, people have also studied some of these examples since field theory terms and come to a similar conclusion. Okay. So, let me just explain. So, if you take the threefold singularities, then a very simple set of family of supersymmetric quantum field theories. The D3 braids probing singularities. So you need to take K even. If K is odd, then you can't. There's no Kuiper resolution, which means you have problems even writing the application to start with. So you need K even for that reason. You can compute the vacuum moduli space of these gauge theories, i.e., you set the F term to 0 and the D term to 0 on gauge transformations, and you get the classical singularity that you want. Moreover, you can do A maximization for these theories and get the A central charge. It's a whole family, so it depends non-trivially on P. This actually, I didn't write it down, it's some non-trivial expression in terms of P here. And you can also compute the volumes on the right-hand side by assuming that the metric exists. And you can therefore compute the volume. And you get a new number. So you compute the central charge, you compute the volume, and they agree. So this calculation is already done, but then so the subtle thing is that neither side exists in this correspondence. So what I've explained here is the geometry side, the Einstein metric doesn't exist because of these obstructions. So in fact, all k bigger than 3 violates the Schneerowitz bound, which on the field theory side says that some operator violates the unitarity bound. That's what you see. And then k equals 3 is a little more tricky. So for that case, we don't know any field theory, actually, because the singularity doesn't admit the Calabi-Yau resolution, the frequent resolution. But it also doesn't admit the metric, but that was proven using a completely different method, just a couple of months ago. So I think, it's a kind of, I'm finished, but it's kind of a moral point that if you have some duality, very often we check BPS things on each side as a check, so two things are dual to each other. So here's an example where you can compute something non-trivial on each side, which is BPS, and they agree, but neither side exists. So I just think it's a kind of maybe a moral or warning about checking BPS things, that sometimes you can get agreements between two sides, even though neither side actually makes any sense. Okay, I'll stop there.
Any other questions? So, is it possible that in these examples it's not Einstein's Sasaki going?
Yeah. yeah, so I think.
Because I guess it's the constraints that you get from the bound is again assuming that there is Einstein's Sasaki.
Right.
So it's not. I do not think of this as just an argument against me.
Right. So I think that's probably the solution. So I also mentioned this paper, Kupfer-Fatter-Witten paper, where they look at Calabi-Yau four folds. And so they look at these ADE singularities, and they're looking at a Calabi-Yau four folds that develops some conical isolated singularity, exactly the sort I've been discussing. So and then they relate that to a 2D field theory. So they look at 2A string theory on that space. They relate it to a 2D field theory by computing BPS things on each side of the matching. So what I can definitely say in the geometry is those conical singularities, they don't exist. They don't have Ricci collapse integers. So that I can say for sure, but I mean I'm sure the resolution is that there's some flux solution which warps that this is not a Ricci collapse integer, which warps the solution, and then there'd be okay. In this other field theory, the three-dimensional case, I think the story is probably quite different. I mean, there it really seems, well, it's not settled what happens to these field theories in the red. I mean, there's still no definite answer to what happens to it. I mean, it's definitely future work. I don't think it's an easy question to answer.
But the flux rule deforms the C of T, right? So basically you're making a statement that those C of Ts do not exist.
Could flow to some solution with flux. Yeah. All that we know by this argument is it doesn't flow to an Einstein. That's all I can say at the moment. But having said that, I mean, this work that I've described can be extended to flux solutions with some work. I mean, probably difficult, but it should certainly be doable. I mean, everything I've said should make sense with fluxes. Just a little bit more involved.
Any further questions, comments? I guess I'm